The following program contains mature language and spoilers. Listener discretion advised.
Welcome to the Marvel Superheroes Podcast. I'm your moderator, Diablo Frank, and later I'll be joined by my co-hosts, The Illegal Machine and Mr. Fix-It. But we have such a large amount of mail to cover this episode that rather than do a full-length feature, I wanted to do a short segment ahead of our answering the mail. Previously, we discussed Sub-Mariner, who we considered the first Marvel superhero. He came after Superman, but he was the earliest example of a Marvel character who had superpowers and moved beyond the pulps. But in truth, Marvel Comics began in the pulps. Their first pulp hero that made the jump to comics was Kazar. So in order to look at the origins of Marvel Comics and the Kazar character, you really have to go back to the beginnings of pulps. The earliest example of pulps would actually be the Penny Dreadful of 19th century England, which was a little novel geared toward the masses, the lower classes. It had very sensationalized fictional pieces. Those were ported over to the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in the form of dime novels. There was a heavy emphasis on westerns there. From that point, you get what we consider the actual pulps, which were rough-hewn, black and white, sort of like dime novels, or they were digest-sized magazines. Sometimes they had illustrations, but they tended to be sparse that regard. They were referred to pulps because of how cheap the paper stock was, but also the content was very low rent. You would take something like H.G. Wells or Mary Shelley, and you would dumb it down into its most basic and most accessible elements. The pulps also trafficked heavily in what we now call genre. A lot of detective stories, just like general adventure stories, vigilante tales, period pieces, often set Western times, war stories. They had early science fantasy. I would hesitate to call what was in the pulp science fiction. They usually weren't that thoughtful. More often it would be, say, medieval fantasy tropes, rocket ships, laser pistols, lightsabers, that sort of thing. They would do horror, and also they did what you could call spicy or saucy tales, which was basically spank material. The pulps were very popular from early 20th century up until around the late 30s. As radio and motion pictures gained prominence and accessibility, people started to gear more towards them. Martin Goodman had been in the pulps since 1932. One of the pulps he had put out was Kazar the Great, which was your prototypical Tarzan knockoff. It only lasted for 3 issues. Toward the end of the 30s, Frank Topi, sales manager for Funnies Incorporated, was going from publisher to publisher trying to talk people into carrying more comic books. Funnies Incorporated was the comic studio that we've discussed in previous episodes, where they were packaging whole comic books for publishers, and basically they had the content. They just needed to find somebody to pay them for it and get it out into distribution. So here you had Kazar, who was created and written for prose by Bob Byrne. He was a star of 3 issues of the Pulp magazine, which were published by Martin Goodman's Manvis Publication Incorporated, dating in late 1936. The first story was King of Fang and Claw. That story was loosely adapted into comic form in 1939 by Ben Thompson, who essentially serialized that first pulp into 5 chapters in Marvel Mystery Comics, and then continued from there with new adventures. If you look at the blog, I have a link to 2 sources where you can read the original prose story from the pulp magazine, Kazar the Great. There's a lot of differences from the comic to the pulp, but it's kind of a fun little artifact to take a look at. The first Kazar comic book story from Marvel Comics number 1 begins, John Rand, young owner of a rich diamond field in the Transvaal, is flying from Johannesburg to Cairo with his wife and their 3-year-old son, David. Over the heart of the Belgian Congo, the plane develops motor trouble, and Rand is forced to come down in the thick, wild tropical forest. The plane crashes, all 3 survive, except that the mom's leg is broken. The 3 of them manage to survive for an undefined period of time in the jungle, but they soon attract the attention of Zar, a lion lord of the jungle who watches over David. Also, there's Najaga the leopard, who tries to eat David, but he's fired upon and wounded by John, the father. John also has to kill a snake before it can bite David, and that's when he realizes that David lacks an inborn sense of fear of the animals. He sees them all as friends and companions. John Rand continues to try to signal planes that fly overhead to their presence, and even though this is a busy plane route, consistently they're just just not seen. There's too heavy foliage. Eventually, the mother gains a fever. She dies. John goes a little bit nuts, considers suicide, decides that he needs to live for the sake of his son, because that's what his wife would have wanted. But he's still determined to trek out of the jungle with his son. They attempt to do that, and then a thunderstorm comes along, and John gets battered about the head, gains this sort of weird amnesia where otherwise he's perfectly fine, but for some reason he believes the jungle is his home, and finally accepts that they're just going to live in the jungle for the rest of their days. John grows this luxurious beard that even the lion is envious of, and David starts jumping around from vine to vine just like Tarzan. From his encounters with N'Jaga in the past, David learns to value the bow and arrow, becomes quite a great archer, but he also believes that no one should take a life unless it's absolutely necessary, and he often refrains from killing if he can. Now, one day the lion Zar became trapped in quicksand. David rescued Zar and returned the lion to his wife Sha, and became endeared to Zar in that way. Years later, what appears to be the adolescent period of Kazar, what's described as a fat white man, and some tribesmen he had enlisted begin mining near the campgrounds of the Rans. John tries to ward them off, but the leader, Paul DeCraft, isn't having it and tries to shoot him in the back. David manages to shoot DeCraft in the arm and save his life, but it's not going to stop him from coming after the duo. Once the tribesmen determine that there's only the two whites that are stopping their mining, DeCraft decides that he's going to kill the both of them. David had wandered off from his camp and snuck into DeCraft's, found a mirror. While he's playing with that, he hears a noise, goes back to his camp, and finds that his and his father's house has been burned down, that his father has been mortally wounded. David is captured by a tribesman, and just before DeCraft can execute both of the men, Zar comes along, runs DeCraft off, kills a couple of DeCraft's tribal aides, and leaves David alive to spend his last moments with his father before he passes away. David is, from that point, essentially adopted by Zar the Lion, thus takes on the name Kazar, which means brother of the lion. Kazar is a bit of an immature alpha male dick, but he's mostly a good guy who helps anyone in need, but he didn't prefer beasts over man. He can actually speak the language of the beasts and converses with animals. He usually gives his foes a second chance after beating them, but there's a high recidivism rate in these stories that typically leads to the deaths of the villains and often other people that Kazar cares about because of his mercy. When Kazar does have to kill them, it's usually by his blade, which is always set aside, or by an arrow. Also, one thing that's notable about Kazar is his kryptonite is guns. You pull a gun on him and he totally turns chicken shit. The main characters in the stories are, of course, Zar, the companion lion, Noho, who's a monkey friend, Sha, the maid of Zar, Traja, who's the elephant chieftain, Chaka, who's sort of an ambivalent chief of the monkey tribe. The main villains are Paul DeKurt, often called Fat Face by Kazar, N'Jaga the leopard, and you also have Bardak, who's a monkey that'll come up in the second story.
We got a comment on one of our older podcasts. This is on our Blogspot page, marvelshp.blogspot.com. This is in relation to our Warlock episode, and it is from Liz Birds, and she says, I loved all the suggestions in this episode, especially now that I took advantage of Marvel Unlimited for 99 cents. Again, we are not paid to promote Marvel Unlimited, but we do it a lot. Marvel Cosmic is all completely new to me, and I probably wouldn't have given Adam Warlock a second thought had I not listened. From an outsider's perspective, his premise sounds a bit like something from Star Trek, so I'm intrigued. Oh, and thanks for not spoiling the ending. You're welcome. I love it when a series builds on a previous book rather than contradicts it. I wish DC did that more. Also, I never knew that Ron Liv did Silver Surfer series, so I'm going to add that to my list, too.
Yeah, Silver Surfer would be kind of a... I don't know how entry... Well, I guess... I mean, a lot of people jumped on Silver Surfer in the 90s, so there must be an entry... there must be access in there somewhere for somebody to jump onto that book. I mean, I remember... I think I picked it up when Starlin took over, and I tried a little bit when Englehart was still writing it. She might actually like Captain Marvel, too, the 70s series that Starlin did.
Yeah, Silver Surfer, that was his most popular time when Ron Lim was doing that stuff. I figured if you're going to pick any Silver Surfer to read, it's probably the Ron Lim stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, too, because you can basically come on with that 50th issue, and that was like the dawn of the Chromium Age. I think like that and Ghost Rider 15 with the glow-in-the-dark cover, those were like the first of the enhanced covers that started the whole shebang back in the 90s.
Yeah, and for me... Ron Lim, when I was reading comics, he was the Silver Surfer artist. That's him. When I think Ron Lim, I think Silver Surfer. So I thought that was kind of interesting that I guess we're far enough removed from that that she doesn't even associate the two. But, I know, she's also a DC reader, right? Mostly.
Well, yeah. Actually, I'll be curious to know where Ron Lim exposure came from. I guess maybe he did Green Lantern over at DC and a little bit of Hawkman. Not a lot of DC stuff, though. So I'd be interested to hear from comments where she was exposed to Ron Lim from. But yeah, Lim did Silver Surfer for ages.
I think I looked it up on Wikipedia. It was like 6 years, 50 total issues.
And And it's a shame, too, because you had all those guys leave Marvel and become just millionaires, and Ron Lim was one of the only guys who stayed, and Marvel rewarded him by giving him Surfer, by giving him all the Infinity books, a lot of other stuff. But as soon as his heat cooled, they didn't have anything for him, and he started bouncing around to different publishers, and now he does odds and sods stuff. Most recently, I think he was doing some of the movie tie-in comics, which you know doesn't pay terribly well. It just goes to show that the companies do not reward you for your loyalty.
Yeah, for real. I guess that's how it goes. I guess that's how I bet a lot of those Image guys already learned that lesson before. It's unfortunate for Ron. I never had a problem with Ron Lim. And then if you count all that Infinity War Crusade stuff he did afterwards, he must have drawn Silver Surfer millions of times in the mid to late 90s.
Yeah, from panel to panel, God only knows. Many thousands of times, yeah.
And then, so also for Warlock, you guys have a good, you know, my Warlock, I've always liked the character, but I wouldn't say I've ever sat down and actually read Warlock. Did we suggest in that episode a good pickup point to just, like, a few issues to read for him that you could suggest for her? Or
Warlock is kind of a tricky one. I mean, it's easy if you want to just jump on with Starlin. They've got it collected in trade paperback. They've got an essential edition. Actually, I would say probably go ahead and pick up the essential edition, because that'll reprint a lot of the Roy Thomas, Gil Kane stuff, and then the Starlin stuff, and it gives you a good backstory. The great thing with Starlin on Warlock is that back in the 70s, you weren't paid for one of the pages that you produced for a Marvel comic. So what you had to do is, they told you, we're going to pay you for 21 pages, and you have to give us a 22nd page or something along those lines. So what a lot of artists would do is they'd go and they'd stat in old artwork and do a recap of a previous issue. And Starlin was religious about it. He'd actually do 2 pages of that more often than not. So virtually any issue of Warlock from his initial run has a recap. You can jump right in.
He did that with Dreadstar too, right?
Yeah, but in that instance, it's probably because it was a lot less work for him. I'm pretty sure he got paid for every one of those pages. Episode 2, Marvel Cosmics and Warlock, 2004. Infinity Watcher commented, "More cosmic, love it." Well, you got more cosmic coming. We got more cosmic to work with. Ange wrote, "Annihilation is a Marvel product I did get at the prodding of a buddy who knew I liked DC cosmic stuff. I also have more affinity to Marvel minor leaguers characters as opposed to their main characters. So I'll take Nova and She-Hulk over Spidey and FF any day. But the biggest draw was Annihilus as one of the main villains. I can't get enough of that guy. After the first miniseries, though, I think the whole property seemed to peter out a bit. I only sampled the subsequent minis and didn't grab onto any of the monthlies that came out of it. I went through a Peter David phase for a while and picked up his Captain Marvel comic, Volume 2, where Genus is mad. I thought it was a very fun comic. Anyways, it looks like I might have more to say than I initially thought. Like the podcast a lot. I'm a big fan of Ange's Supergirl comic box commentary blog. We've done a lot of crossovers over the years. I'm happy that he's found a way into the Marvel podcast. I found that, you know, we haven't gotten to the Annihilation stuff yet in recording, but I did very much like the Annihilus character. I thought he was a blast.
And yeah, he's good.
We're definitely going to be covering weird, minor, goofball Marvel characters. I'm the guy who started the DC Bloodlines blog, after all, so I've got the same little hidey holes in the Marvel universe. One of these days, I'm going to get that Red Wolf podcast together. So.
Oh, man.
And the importance of Pip will be explained.
Absolutely. Count Druncula says, "I love how you make a big point of being grateful for comments and reading all of them without summarizing, and then you only read 20% of my comment from the last episode." You know, I don't know about this guy. I think he's having blackouts from the drinking. I distinctly remember Mac reading the entire comments. Let me think back to that.
"We accept characters like Conan and Hercules, otherworldly warrior kings, to strut around in loincloths. I view Submariner in the same light as those characters. With all that in mind, I don't like how Marvel has tried to rebrand him as one of the X-Men over the last couple years. He's not that kind of mutant. Still, he can't pine for Invisible Woman forever, and I think Namor and Emma Frost would be an amazingly enjoyable couple to watch destroy each other. Hot, angry, violent sex interrupted by vicious mind games and manipulations. Henry was the sleazy Frenchman who tried to steal Woody's girlfriend. That's in Cheers. We are best friends because he gets that. I think the Superior Iron Man story with Tony giving extremists to other citizens will have horrible unforeseen consequences, and that's the whole point. It's going to parallel Tony's recklessness in Avengers Age of Ultron, where Tony creates Ultron to police the world, and it goes awry."
Spoilers.
"I've also been a fan of the Falcon for years, and I don't like that Marvel has made Sam Wilson Captain America. This feels too much like a legacy hero move, like promoting the sidekick to replace the fallen hero, and the way Wally West became Flash, Dick Grayson became Batman, and yes, Bucky Barnes became Captain America. The problem with that is that the Falcon isn't a kid sidekick. He's Captain's partner, the lesser of the two, yes, but he had his own established adult hero identity. Turning him into Captain America feels like Marvel saying Falcon wasn't good enough as is."
See, I told you. God, that guy, he just jumps to conclusions. These entitled fanboys, I swear. As an adult, one day out of the blue, Kazar is looking into some water and remembers the mirror from DeKraft's camp, so he goes back to it, and he finds that Bardock has taken the mirror and decides to fight Bardock for it, humbles Bardock, and then sends him on his way. Now, Kazar had been living in the same cave with Zar and Shaw. Shaw, the wife, had never really taken to Kazar, didn't like him, was distrustful of him. Well, Bardock goes back to their cave and steals one of Shaw's cubs and then climbs up a tree with the cub. Shaw tries to get the Monkey King Chaka to make Bardock come down with the cub peaceably, and Chaka just sort of blows her off. Zar tries to climb the tree, can't. So finally, Kazar gets involved because this is essentially his little brother after all. Bardock tries to fling the cub to its death. Kazar catches the cub, climbs up the tree, and stabs Bardock to death. And from that point on, Shaw liked him a lot better. In the third story, Kazar wards off a generally decent guy who's trying to poach animals for a zoo, and he also has another run-in with Najaga. In the fourth story, Paul DeKraft comes back with a similarly avarice helper, Ed Kivlin. They have an adventure with Kazar that involves a lot of death and destruction. That story continues into the fifth episode, as it's termed in the strip. And one thing that's important to note, too, is because these Kazars were an adaptation of the pulps, they have a very serialized feel to them, lots of recurring characters, lots of recurring elements. That's such a hallmark of Marvel Comics, and they were such an early adopter of continuity versus other comic book companies. You see a lot of that here in Kazar. It probably wasn't intentional. It probably came from the adaptation process, but it's the beginnings of what we came to know as Marvel Comics right here. The sixth story is where Ben Thompson takes over the full writing on the strip, and it's pretty brutal. It starts out with a guide whose eyes have been gouged out by a poacher who's slaughtering elephants for their ivory. Kazar, of course, puts an end to that. In the seventh story, a criminal pilot strands a botanist and his daughter in the jungle with the intent of extorting money and sexual favors out of the lot, which of course draws the ire of Kazar. The eighth issue involves more dirty dealings and unwanted intrusions into the jungle. The ninth story involves Kazar saving a young white woman and her father from unfriendly tribesmen. In the tenth story, a Western criminal is being transported by plane when it is forced to land in the Congo, and Kazar has to bring that crook to justice. You might start seeing a bit of a repetition there. To be honest, Kazar was a script that I was hesitant to read. I was putting it on the back burner. But when I did dive into it, I found that it was actually entertaining. It was somewhat more so than the other more notable strips in Marvel Comics. But at the same time, it does fall victim to being a jungle strip, and there are certain tropes that are just going to get played through over and over again. Things that are very common is that people from outside the jungle are referred to as Omen, especially white people. And the Omen are typically dressed for safari. They use guns or whips. They're typically bad guys, and they're usually trying to exploit the animals or the jungles itself. Then there are the blacks, and they're always referred to as the blacks. They're natives, they dress like tribesmen, they carry spears, they tend to get whipped by the Omen. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, but they're always cowardly. They're superstitious over the white jungle guard, and whenever shit hits the fan, they just go running. It's pretty lame. Especially the first 10 stories or so, one thing I noticed is that the stories always seem to end before the reader was ready, which was nice, because a lot of times Marvel Mystery Comics stories just seem to go on and on endlessly. It was great that the Kazars kind of popped and they moved quickly, and although they did sometimes end somewhat abruptly. Ben Thompson was not a very pretty artist, but he had an unusually clear storytelling with numbered panels. You'd be looking at a page, and rather than numbering the pages, if you had trouble following the panels, he would actually number each individual panel in sequence so you'd know where the eye was supposed to go. Very helpful. He was also an early adopter of conventional panel sizes and linear panel progression. When you picture a comic book page, especially from the Silver Age, Ben Thompson was already doing that in 1939. Captions and dialogue anticipate the depth and detail of the Silver Age as well. It's a shame that the stories were so racially insensitive and basic, but they were refreshingly straightforward as opposed to the dream logic of a lot of the other tales in these books. In the 11th issue, Thompson attempted another long-form narrative. Basically, a situation occurs where Kazar and Zar are trapped on a boat that ends up taking them to the United States, and they have a series of adventures trying to get out of the U.S. They confront Nazis at one point. It's this whole big process. The main dilemma of the story is resolved in Marvel Mystery Comics number 15, which is the last issue available on Marvel Comics Unlimited. It's not as engaging as the initial five-part story, but it is nice to see Kazar in a different environment doing something besides the same rote types of stories that he'd been doing. Kazar continued to appear in Marvel Mystery Comics through the 27th issue. He appeared in every single issue to that point. He also had a guest appearance in the story The Human Torch Battles the Submariner as the World Faces Destruction from the fall 1941 issue of Human Torch. Kazar was also a fixture in house ads for Marvel Mystery Comics, which typically featured headshots of the various characters in the stories. And in fact, Kazar's final appearance of the Golden Age was in February 1942's Captain America Comics number 11, as an advertisement. By that point, he had already left Marvel Mystery Comics. His feature was done with, but he is in the ad. He's riding an elephant that's carrying a big copy of Marvel Mystery Comics that's surrounded by all the characters being featured in the book. Human Torch, Submariner, The Patriot, Terry Vance, The Vision, Jimmy Jupiter, and The Angel. But despite appearing in the ad, Kazar's name isn't mentioned there. Something of an indignant farewell to the character. The David Rand version of Kazar was replaced in the 1960s by the more familiar Kevin Plunder. To the best of my knowledge, David Rand as Kazar has not appeared in a Marvel comic since 1942. Okay, moving on. Episode number 3, the SDCC 2014 FYI. Count Dracula again. He got smart. He started numbering his responses. Number 1, I thought X-Men Days of Future Past was very disappointing. I won't say more because it sounds like 66.66% of you haven't seen it yet. But I was let down and I had zero emotional connection to the characters that I grew up loving as a kid. 2, I never would have considered Joaquin Phoenix for Doctor Strange, but the more I think about it, the more I'm okay with it. I agree that charisma and charm isn't something that typically comes out of his performances, but I think he does have that range buried in his toolbox. I did see Her and thought he did an outstanding job. I also liked him in Signs, the last M. Night Shyamalan movie worth watching. At the same time, I totally hear Frank's position on breaking away from male white stars in the Marvel Universe. I would be cool with Marvel casting an Asian actor as a Sorcerer Supreme, John Cho, though. The idea gets more acceptable the longer I sit with it. I don't like the TV series Sleepy Hollow, but my wife loves it, so I watch it for Nicole B. Harry. I'm sure I butchered that. Cho plays a somewhat sympathetic villain there, so between that and Star Trek, I no longer think of Harold and Kumar when I see him. As it stands right now, we'll have to wait until 2017 or 18 before Luke Cage headlines a Netflix series. I'm crossing my fingers that Marvel announces Black Panther for May or November 2017. Before anybody asks, I have multiple volumes of the Luke Cage Essentials ready to go as soon as that series is podcast worthy.
Yes!
Hey, Mr. Fix-It, mm-hmm. How do you feel about Joaquin Phoenix as Doctor Strange?
I think it would be a different take on it. I think he could pull it off. He has a nice range. I mean, from Quills to Walk the Line.
Okay, number 3. I'm also a lot more intrigued by DC's current television output than their films. Arrow's second season was 100 times more enjoyable as a pure guilty pleasure than his freshman year, and a big part of that had to do with the Easter eggs and guest characters from the DC Universe. I am 95% positive that Brandon Routh's character was originally conceived to be Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle, but when the Flash pilot met with such praise and kicked down the door for actual superheroes, the Arrow showrunners decided to reimagine him as more than just a baseline human street fighter like Green Arrow. Hence, Ted Kord, brilliant scientist and CEO, becomes Ray Palmer, brilliant scientist and CEO. Okay, we'll run with that. Gotham sounds like it's getting a lot of good buzz. That disappoints me because I want the show to fail. The premise is preposterous and I think self-defeating. I'm sure the idea of seeing Bruce Wayne as a tormented 8-year-old will be fascinating for viewers for like the first 3 episodes, and then people are going to want Batman. Personally, I could see Ray Palmer becoming a CEO. I wish that had been his natural progression rather than just becoming some bland research scientist at a university. I like him better as a more... to me, I always thought Ray Palmer was a Republican. He was an A-type. He was a kind of a... he'd want more than just to be a research scientist. So, and I just can't... Ted Kord always seemed to be the guy who was in that position and didn't want to be. Brandon Routh strikes me as the kind of guy who can play to that A-type and work well. So I'm actually happy that it's not Ted Kord. Did you watch any of Arrow?
I have just seen the first episode because someone kept praising the hell out of it. It was interesting. I mean, I can't really talk about the show because I've only been one episode in, but I've enjoyed what I've seen so far.
I've never been able to make it more than a few minutes before I just...
It's a lot darker than I thought it would be. Having him killing people, that was kind of... Oh, spoiler.
Number 4. I think I broke Frank's heart by describing Wonder Woman's costume as fine on Twitter after I saw the image released at SDCC. Let me clarify, justify, I do not like this depiction of Wonder Woman. What bothered me, like it slapped me in the face when I saw it, was the lack of color in this picture, or any picture associated with this movie, or its rotting pustule of a predecessor in Man of Steel. In terms of the actual aesthetic of the costume, the Greco-Roman warrior look, well, that is not what I would have preferred, but it is exactly what I expected. The design of the costume and the inclusion of a sword in her hand, the treatment of Diana as Beast on the battlefield is exactly how I figured they would try to sell the character to modern audiences. It didn't bother me because it didn't surprise me. I just sighed and said whatever. I would prefer Wonder Woman's costume look a bit more like a woman's tennis player, uniform, functional, but clearly feminine too. I wholeheartedly agree that Zack Snyder is missing the point of the climactic scene of The Dark Knight Returns by putting it in the movie. He doesn't understand the context. He just knows an iconic visual when he sees one. See Watchmen. Also, I would rather watch Superman Returns 50 times before I saw Man of Steel again.
Ooh. That's pretty rough. Because as we all know, Superman Returns was god-awful.
I have no recollection of that. I remember a plane sequence, and I remember the shanking, and I remember the lifting, and I remember a kid and a piano. It's just like it's just a fuzzy memory, half images.
To me, when I watch that movie, I imagine DC burning like Rome, like just files on fire and employees going savage, killing each other because it was such a bad movie, such a bad idea. So to watch that 50 times over Man of Steel, I got to give you Man of Steel. Again, a friend of mine really loves the movie. He still claims the best comic book movie. Don't see it. Yes, he's fanatical about it. I mean,
Is he at least like some kind of crazy Superman fan?
No, actually, he's a huge Doctor Doom fan. Huge Doom fan. Well,
that's the killingest Superman we've ever had.
Yeah, so I told him to go see Galaxy. He liked Galaxy a lot, but still was like, oh, it's one of the best. And I'm just like, I didn't see it. I mean, it was interesting. And he's right. Zack Snyder does work more with imagery and less with story. Because when you really watch it, like I for some reason own the movie. I've watched it maybe 3 times. The first time was interesting. Second time I was more, why am I watching this? By the third time I'm like, wow, it's really pretty to look at, but the story is just kind of your very atypical free comic book month type of story. Like, no, there's no real thought put into it. With the old Batman versus Superman or Superman versus Batman, it's going to be comic book free month comic story again with two characters.
How'd you feel about the Wonder Woman costume?
It's a little glitzy. Like, she didn't really come off. When I think of Wonder Woman, I think Xena. I don't think Vegas Showgirl. Like, that's kind of what she looked like to me. She
was really into Xena as the frame of reference.
She looks like Xena in the picture. I think you need to look at the picture again. There's nothing glitzy about the picture. It's all two colors.
She's very bronze.
Yeah,
the whole picture is brown.
She's like model thin. It's just, she doesn't look like a warrior. No scarring. Like, when I imagine Wonder Woman, which she very rarely, I think, gets done right, because I'm not very interested in her, but when I do see her, I think of this chick's a little battle scar. She's a little battle worn.
She's not talking about the picture. You're talking about the chick.
One of the character, but no, even the image, because we got an old Batman, we got a Superman, so you think you would have Wonder Woman being introduced as a war-worry character. She's come in, she's seen a lot of shit, she's going to be this mix that neither of them, you know, got an old Batman, semi-young Superman, so that's what I was expecting for Wonder Woman, and instead I get the showgirl popping up with a sword and a shield. You looked at Xena, and she looked like a warrior. She had a little bit of weight to her.
You're talking about Lucy Lawless projected that persona.
Yeah.
She wasn't a stick, she had some
She looked like she could fight.
Yeah.
You know, now, side note, I didn't watch Xena because I wanted to. Much like you watching Sleepy Hollow, I had to watch this because of my significant other at the time.
Every season.
Yeah, God, it was... Wow. Amazing sometimes. But by watching her, I could see, yeah, this could be a Wonder Woman type character. Xena was definitely based off of Wonder Woman. She should look like someone who could take on Superman and hold her own and beat the shit out of Batman if she had to. She looks more like the early Wonder Woman coming and typing for the Justice League and pairing a tray of drinks.
Gina Carano.
You would know this shit, man.
You ever see Haywire? The Fast and Furious movies, right?
Okay, Haywire. You're talking about the
Steven Soderbergh action movie.
Yeah, I could see her.
She could kick the fuck out of Fassbender.
She's the same chick that came out in the Fast and the Furious movie,
yeah,
right?
But that's the thing. If you look at the Fast and the Furious movies, you've got Michelle Rodriguez.
No.
Gina Carano, Jordana Brewster, Elsa Pataky. You've got Gal Gadot. Okay, Gal Gadot is the one who got cast as Wonder Woman. Of those five women, she would be my fifth choice to play Wonder Woman in the Fast and the Furious series alone.
Now, do we know in the Wonder Woman movie, the Batman Superman movie, is she going to fly? Does she have Wonder Woman's powers? Or is she just going to be running around a lot? I'm pretty sure we don't have an invisible jet. I'm pretty sure.
Taking in all the information I have on the movie so far, I don't care. If she flies...
They should have got the chick from Thor, period.
Well, I'll tell you...
She would never leave, dude.
She's probably going to have like a Jeep or some other vehicle like the Batman Tumbler where it's very practical-ish.
So are they going Kevin Nolan, like realistic, like this could almost happen? Or are they really going to go back to... Because I think that's where DC is kind of failing a lot, where Marvel's smart, where it's not based in reality, but it's their universe, so you buy into their universe. Where DC, I'm not sure if we're supposed to buy into their universe or we're buying into they're in our universe. So that's where I get mixed up, because you watch the Nolan stuff and it feels like it's our universe. You watch the Snyder stuff and it's someone else's universe. So there's like a disconnection, at least for me as a viewer.
I do feel like they're doing their own thing, and I it's not a thing that I can groove to.
Well, I can agree with you there.
My sister asked me if I was into Coheed and Cambria, and I was like, no, and don't bring it up again. And she tried to extol the virtues, and like, I'm really glad you enjoy Coheed and Cambria, but I, no. They do comic books. Yeah, I know. I've read one of the comic books. No. You enjoy it. You can have
they're
that.
They're a kitschy band.
Point being, they're not for me. Though. Yeah. And I really don't see the Snyder movies for me. And I really wish that there was a Wonder Woman movie for me. And maybe there will be. But so far, it doesn't look too good.
I don't know. I just, the vibe I'm getting, like, I made the mistake of watching shows talk about Galaxy before they came out. And they were all like, ooh, well, I'm not sure if Galaxy is going to be any good because this is. And I sat there and I thought, like, you're judging this based on limited footage. So I feel like I'm basing this a lot on just limited footage. I've seen maybe a little bit of that leaked footage from Comic-Con, and I've seen some pictures, and I don't want to put too much into what I'm saying now until I see some more finished product. But, you know, you want to whet their appetite a little bit, and this did not whet my appetite for the movie.
My issue is just, I'm so glad that Goyer's not as closely related to the movie now as he was with Man of Steel. I'm not going into this going, yeah, I'm going to hate this. This is going to suck. I can't wait to shit all over this movie. I'm a DC fan. I love Wonder Woman. I want to see a great Wonder Woman movie. I don't care as much about seeing a great Superman or Batman movie. Hope that I'm pleasantly surprised, but I have not seen or heard anything that makes me think that there's any cause for such a benefit of the doubt.
Well, the funny thing is, I have friends that read, and I have some friends that are very DC, and I have friends that are very Marvel, and I've noticed a big rift now of people, the Marvel guys, kind of hating the DC movie, saying, you know, I don't think it's going to be as good or any good, where the DC fans are like, no, you just haven't seen yet. It's going to get better from here. And Batman is one of my favorite DC characters. But I'm just wondering if this, how this is going to affect the industry, like in terms of Marvel DC fanboys, because like the Marvel fanboys that I'm friends with are really hating on it. And I'm like, how can you hate some if you've seen two pictures of it? That's like reading a word from a comic and saying, oh, it sucks.
Well, there was a lot of animosity toward Man of Steel. I think in part because, as with that Superman Returns, Superman wasn't the most capable superhero in his movie. There was a lot of people dying, a lot of bad stuff happening, and he wasn't very useful in protecting those people from a 9/11 type situation. And in the movie prior to that, he ran around lifting a bunch of stuff, wouldn't throw a punch, too pacifistic for their taste. But I think part of it, and again, I'm speaking as a DC guy, I switched from Marvel to DC in the early 90s. For 20 years, I was pumped about DC stuff. They just keep wanting to feed you Superman, Batman in the movies. On television, it was pulling teeth to get other heroes. You finally started to see a lot of those guys turning up on Smallville, and I'm seeing they're packing the Flash show and the Arrow show with characters. I'm seriously thinking about looking at the upcoming Arrow series because of Ray Palmer and how enthusiastic I am about seeing him adapted. But Marvel has been giving us a universe of characters since 2008. They've been alluding to a universe, and their movies, while I don't like several of them, I know that I'm less enthusiastic about Guardians than either one of you. But they are consistently entertaining, and they're consistently giving me opportunities to explore different characters and different scenarios, where I've been seeing the same two Superman and Batman movies, variations of those, for my entire life.
Sure.
I'm tired of those characters. I'm tired of the type of stories that they feel the need to tell with those characters. And what I'm especially sick of is the Nolan movies didn't wow me the way that most people did. I liked The Dark Knight like most everybody else. I didn't care for the other two. And that aesthetic has bled into all the DC movies. So every DC movie is a Nolan Batman movie, and those characters are being twisted and contorted to fit that aesthetic. It makes me angry, but more than that, it just makes me want to disassociate myself. Those aren't the characters I care to experience, and I don't care to frustrate myself. I don't want to be one of those guys who get on the internet and just get angry at people all the time. So I just assume, set it aside. Unless I hear spectacular reviews on Superman versus, or Batman versus Superman, I'm just not going to bother with it.
And see, my problem is, at least with Marvel, I really feel like we're going to have a payoff at the end. And they're always hinting. And of course, I'm a huge Thanos fan. I was a huge Thanos fan before Thanos was really a big deal. I remember reading about it.
It was a bonding experience.
Yeah.
We were first getting to know each other, and you finding out that I was into the same material, the Starlet material, Thanos in particular.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't hold a candle to your fandom for Thanos, but I do love that character.
And
one
so
of great villains in comics.
And
better than Darkseid. Fuck all of y'all.
Oh, and by the way, if you want to compare Thanos to someone, Lord Papple. If you're going to compare Lord someone, Papple. A badass. But if you're going to compare him, Lord Papple's, I mean, hands down, about the best comparison. Darkseid is just so boring.
Well, that and Metron.
Metron.
Many people look at the superficial similarity to Darkseid. He has a lot in common with Metron. And I see
could
a
see
lot
that.
Of that.
But my thing is, with Marvel, I feel like there's a payoff. Mm-hmm. like that. My fear is when I get to that payoff, we won, we crossed the finish line. What's next? Where DC, it feels like you're just running around in circles. Like you don't. There's nowhere. We're not running to a goal. There's not like all these DC movies are building up to this great story arc. It's more like, well, we're just throwing stories at you.
My thing is, I'm perfectly happy with an artist taking a character and going to a bizarre dimension with it. I think it is a tragedy that we lost Edgar Wright on Ant-Man, and pretty sure that the need to build this comprehensive universe that's interconnected, it hurt the Ant-Man movie, something that could have been spectacular. I would love it if Warner Brothers could do with the DC characters the sort of thing that Edgar Wright looked like he was going to do with Ant-Man, where he was going to have a personal vision, but in a mainstream commercial vehicle. But instead, we're getting the worst of both worlds, where we don't have a strong artistic vision, we don't have any autonomy, since Snyder is basically a continuation of Nolan. And Nolan wasn't another universe away from the Tim Burton movies either.
Yeah.
It's all the same vision from DC, there's no variety. With Marvel, there is this bureaucracy, and I do see how that can be stifling. I know, you know, there's never been a director that's worked with them more than twice. But at the same time, at least Marvel's trying to explore some different areas. At least they're going out to a broader variety of talent and getting better movies and a bigger universe of concepts to play with out of. That's my big thing.
I think Ant-Man's going to be one. I still got to see somebody. I just got a weird vibe of that one.
Count Dracula, remember when he was in this conversation. Point five. I love Clark Gregg as Agent Coulson, but the first season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was not good enough to justify bringing him back from the dead. And as Frank points out, they brought him back for the entirely wrong role in this ensemble. While the season did get better, I was still angry and hateful toward it when I watched the season finale. And yet, I will most likely come back to watch the second season because I like the bits of information that I've heard. When they introduced Mockingbird, I think it would be fun if they established she has kind of a fangirl crush on Hawkeye. Then if they can get Grinner to appear in an episode this season, like they had Samuel Jackson appear last year, they can play up his first meeting with her crush.
I think that worked well. If you can't have Mockingbird and not have Hawkeye,
the connection to Hawkeye,
you can't not do that.
And especially even if they were going in a different direction, antagonistic rather than a relationship, that would still address that. They have to have some sort of a strong connection, whether it's positive or negative. At least you have to address that the connection was there in the comics. Number six, I was happy with the casting of Paul Rudd as Scott Lang, if for no other reason than he's the first actor not named Chris to get the leading role in a Marvel film in like 6 years. I agree that This Is 40 was both too long and not funny, but Paul Rudd gave a pretty memorable, charming, and comical recurring spot on season 4 of Parks and Recreation. While Marvel, it does get kind of inbred, there's a lot of these guys popping up in each other's stuff. While Marvel has been billing Ant-Man as a heist movie, both before and after Edgar Wright's departure from the lineup of characters introduced at SDCC, I'm thinking the larger thematic tone of the film will be legacy, specifically the legacy of Hank Pym. You've got Evangeline Lilly as Pym's daughter, his biological legacy, and then Rudd and Stoll play sort of opposing sides of the same idea. Stoll's daring cross represents failure, perhaps unintended consequences, while Scott Lang offers the chance for redemption. These ideas are sort of addressed in Iron Man 2 and Thor, but I think it'll be much, much more upfront this time around, and I'm hopeful about this if nothing else. Hashtag Janet Van Crime. Anybody, because there's a bit of big furor that Janet Van Dyne, a founding member of the Avengers, one of Marvel's first heroines of the Marvel Age, has been retroactively killed off in this movie and will not be a part of the Marvel Universe.
Any of the series.
The Avengers.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I think it's a shame. I think it's a lost. It's a missed opportunity to introduce somebody who's not a white guy, as we've discussed several times in the movie. I mean, you got Janet Van Dyne. I know she's Wasp, and you may think that Wasp is lame, but you're making a goddamn Ant-Man movie, so you're telling me you can't make Wasp worth a shit? No. So I don't understand the reasoning behind it. It doesn't make any sense. And she's one of the stronger, more, and she is the MO. For the type of character Marvel's looking to make famous. They're characters that nobody's really super invested in, but that have interesting backgrounds, and the concrete foundation is there to give to a creator in a movie and say, just go with it. You don't have Batman fanboys and Superman fanboys and Spider-Man fanboys that you have to even pretend to be loyal to for a second. Run with it. And instead they ran too far and just got rid of her. So.
And now people are pissed off just the very idea of not having a Janet Van Dyne in Marvel Universe.
Makes no sense. She led the Avengers for God's sake.
You wonder though, because if Michael Douglas is playing an aged Hank Pym, whether there's going to be more retro adventures in the Marvel Universe. Maybe she was in a prototype team.
Hell, they can bring in the Agents of Atlas if they're so inclined. So it's still possible to use that character. She hasn't been completely taken off the table, but it is a shame that you don't have somebody who's contemporaneous. You know, I like Black Widow a lot more now than I did before these movies got started, but I would like to see some more impressive.
Yep.
Okay, Siskoid wrote, like Frank, I avoid spoilers and want to be surprised at the theater, as often happens, because I don't go to the movies alone and always skip outings that feature a 3D showing on DVD. I want them to go a different way from the comics. My apathy for something like Sin City is a good example. It was all deja vu right down to specific panels. Guess who hasn't seen the Watchmen film yet? That's right, this guy. Because this is my first comment on a contemporaneous episode, hell, we got that in there twice. That's a big word club. I thought I might give you my Marvel resume. After all, I'm more of a DC guy with the topics I cover, etc., but my teen years were indeed filled with Marvel books, specifically 80s stuff, Avengers, West Coast Avengers, Cap as the Captain, Burn on FF, and Alpha Flight. Canadian. The X-Men, of course, and also X-Factor. Buscema's Wolverine and New Mutants, Miller's Daredevil, and I loved Nascenti's more. He loved Nascenti more than Miller, okay. Power Pack, Simonson's Thor, Iron Man and the Armor Wars, Peter David's Hulk, Michelinie's, is that how you pronounce that?
We don't know.
Michelinie's Spider-Man, the original run of What If, Marvel Universe Deluxe. You remember that time. In the very early 90s, I quit the whole universe, coinciding with the release of X-Men number 1, I think. All the books I was following had a big drop in quality and were getting stale, and as the gimmicks came in and took over, I was out. I wouldn't pick up another Marvel book until Carl Kiesel's Daredevil. A few books then, and I was soon out again. Mind you, as 2000 hit, I dropped out of comics entirely, coming back around 2008. These days, I'd say the big two are not my main comics consumption, but Marvel outpaces DC's New 52. Not the big core books that always get involved in crossovers, X-Books and Avengers books, but the ones that showcase the most variety. Spider-Man, all spinoffs except Team-Up, been very good too. Wade's DD, She-Hulk, Hawkeye, Ms. Marvel, Loki Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., Moon Knight, Magneto, Black Widow, Ghost Rider, Silver Surfer, and others. Marvel currently allows itself some humor and doesn't make all its books look and feel the same. I certainly appreciate that. So those are my specialties and blind spots. I look forward to the podcast strengthening the former and filling in the latter.
Excellent. We look forward to more comments.
Yes, and there are a number of the series that were referenced that I definitely want to tackle. Hawkeye especially, I'm looking forward to reading as soon as possible.
Man, they just... don't get me on a Hawkeye rant.
What about the Hawkeye?
Because he's one of my favorite Marvel characters, and he's one of my least favorite characters in the movies.
Well, his current series is critically acclaimed. And
yeah, it's good. It's good. I've read about the first 10.
So that's something we ought to get on. Ange, final comment. This is a Marvel podcast, and all I am going to talk about is DC Comics. It's hard to know which movie was worse, Superman Returns or Man of Steel. Superman Returns is a weird pick, an over-homage to the Donner films down to the plot. It has a creepy voyeur, absent father, non-punching Superman. That said, the jet rescue scene is great, and the scene where Superman hoists the growing cave-infused landmass, dying and sacrificing himself to save the world, is everything Superman is about. And Ruth had the charm to be both Clark and Superman. Still, that means 85% of the movie is pretty rough. Contrast it with The Man of Steel on the opposite end of the spectrum. Overly violent, overly loud, great tone, horrible film. A movie where Superman watches his dad die, where he kills Zod, where he lets Metropolis crumble around him. I would watch Returns 100 times before I would watch MOS. Now the next movie is a film where Batman fights Superman, where Wonder Woman is a mass of tan. The posters are Batman sad, Superman brooding, and Diana angry. Simply put, the wrong creators are attached to these properties. I don't know if there's too much that we can add than what we already said with Count Dracula. I agree with pretty much everything Ange said, except that I would rather watch Man of Steel over Superman Returns. I'd rather see a movie that's offensive but somewhat interesting over a film that is relatively inoffensive but boring as fuck.
True.
Wing out the gimp.
The Masked Raider debuted in November 1939's Marvel Comics number 1. He was created by the strip's writer-artist Al Anders, who didn't do a heck of a lot else. The origin story takes place in Cactusville, in which Jim Hardley refuses to give up his ranch to land baron Cal Brunder. So Brunder gets him on a trumped-up cattle-rustling charge, and he's locked away in jail by Sheriff Steve. in his cell, Gardley realizes that he's young and strong, and if anybody was going to do something about guys like Hal Brunder, it ought to be him. So he pretends like he's dying, lures Sheriff Steve into the cell, pops him one in the mouth, and then runs off. Gardley steals a horse, runs off to camp out in the hills, and then sends the horse back because he's no rustler. Shortly after that, he raids his own ranch for supplies, and he hides out in the hills for weeks, training as a quick draw. The Masked Raider is still missing one vital component of a Lone Ranger ripoff, which is his own trick horse. He finds a wild horse out on the range. Over the course of an indeterminate amount of time, manages to finally wrangle and break that horse, who he names Lightning, and would continue to have adventures with him throughout the series. Once he feels he's suitably proficient as a gunslinger, and while wearing the same clothes he'd been arrested in, the Masked Raider is born by donning a solid black mask that looks like something from a creepy bondage video, and he swears, "I, Jim Gardley, hereby make a solemn vow to forever fight the lawless, bring justice to the oppressed, and help the poor. To this end, I, the Masked Raider, dedicate my life to this oath." In Gardley's absence, the reign of terror of Cal Brunder continued. He's murdering people, continuing to frame people, and finally the townsfolk essentially give up and decide they'd rather sell out than be burned out. Sheriff Steve does protest, but he doesn't have any actual spine. The Masked Raider shoots one of Cal Brunder's evil hands and leaves his still living but pretty badly shot up body lying in town with a note pinned to it. It read, "Brunder, you and your gang must pay for all your crimes. I'm starting to collect. Signed, in cursive, the Masked Raider." The Raider then secretly enlists the aid of the clueless sheriff. However, he's spotted by one of the evil ranch hands and then another one of the evil ranch hands. So while they're arguing about who's going to plug the sheriff and the Masked Raider, the Raider comes around and bonks their heads together like a Three Stooges comedy. Soon after, the Masked Raider confronts the main evil ranch hand, Slick. It's worth noting, too, that you've heard those rules about the lettering that was put down in the Golden Age, because the lettering was so bad and the printing was so bad that words would tend to merge together. And you can see the insight in that, because Slick, when you're reading the story, he seems to be called Suck. You have to stop and remind yourself, no, he's meant to be Sick, Slick, not Suck. But anyway, Slick sees the Masked Raider, he's like, you're masked! And that seems to be the reaction of most people in the origin story. I think it has to do with the mask, since it's solid black with just sort of like white eye indications and a smiling white mouth indication, which seems to just be a trick of the light that is advantageous for the comic strip. I don't know why they're so freaked out by a masked man, but then again, you see this guy and you think he's going to do things to you. Instead, in this instance, Masked Raider just beats the heck out of Slick, and that brings in the other evil hands coming after the Masked Raider, but at the same time, the ruckus also drew the attention of the townspeople, who fell upon the ranch hands, beat them all up, and retook their town. Bruni hears about this and tries to escape, but the Masked Raider lassos him and turns him over to the law. Rather than just return to his own life, the Masked Raider, you know, rides off into the distance, and the sheriff asks himself, "Brunder's finished, but will the masked man tackle the bigger game?" And in fact, he did. There's no indication that the sheriff ever figures out that Jim Gardley and the Masked Raider are one and the same. The Masked Raider's main defining characteristics was that he was a super quick draw, to the point where you pretty much in the comics never see him reach for his gun and draw. It's always like one panel, everything's fine. Next panel, somebody's already had something shot out of their hand. Many of the strips refer to the Masked Raider's flaming guns. He's a fairly tough hombre. A number of the stories mention that he's disguised as a cowboy, but when he's going from place to place, I don't understand why he doesn't just act on his own as Jim Gardley. It doesn't really matter anymore. But that might also play into a issue with the strip is that nobody has distinct features. Everybody kind of looks alike, with a few exceptions. He draws a male, an old male, and that's about it. Jim Gardley's features wouldn't be consistent from story to story anyway. There are a lot of terrible accents. The script is written largely phonetically, often in a thick southern accent, occasionally in Mexican. These are not flattering depictions, and they make it really hard to read sometimes. Again, you can't easily tell characters apart, and sometimes you'll have essentially the same figure with the same face fighting with himself, and the only way you can tell people apart is by the colors of their outfits sometimes. The storytelling is also unclear. This is a strip that very much needs to have stuff told to you in dialogue and captions, because you can't tell what's going on just from the art alone oft times. The Masked Raider has no clear motivation. The stories are rather repetitive. There aren't very many characters in the strip, and I mean, like in each story, people mostly just speak in exposition. There's not a lot of depth to them. The strip doesn't always have the lead character at the beginning, and sometimes not even in the middle. This is a strip that very often backgrounds the lead character, and also Jim Gardley, disguised as a cowboy, is more often the protagonist than the Masked Raider himself, or at least Azoth. The second Masked Raider story is one of the better ones. In disguise as a cowboy, the Masked Raider infiltrates a camp of crooks and he battles a boss who has a hook for a hand. What's also neat is these guys' base had a skeleton of the sheriff that they had killed out in front, just as a deterrent. The third Mask Raider story is essentially exactly the same as the origin, except in that one there was a crooked sheriff involved, instead of just an incompetent one. A fourth story is about two old big mouth prospectors who get themselves in trouble when someone tries to steal their claim. The fifth story was actually one of the most interesting, in which there's a series of frame-ups going on as part of a conspiracy to steal the sheriff's office election. The sixth story introduced me to the term wet beef, which apparently means cattle that are rustled and taken across the border into Mexico. No, wait, that was the seventh story. I got confused. They kind of run together after a while. Oh, Lord, the eighth story. This one introduces Mexican Pete, and if that sounds like a bad idea in a strip known for stereotypes and heavy, horrible accents, yeah, Pete is just sleeping on the porch of a bank that is robbed, and then he helps the Mask Raider. The story itself is actually alright. It's got a little bit of a mystery to it, but unfortunately it also promises the return of Mexican Pete. That happens in the ninth episode, where miners who are trying to transport their claims via stagecoach keep having the stagecoach raided. Blessedly, that's the second and final appearance of Mexican Pete. Another swiftly established cliche of the strip is that everybody from the second story on knows who the Mask Raider is, so in the tenth story, when people keep going, "Who's this guy?" it's kind of jarring. And because he's not known as a hero, the Mask Raider actually has to kidnap the daughter of, I believe, the sheriff, and use her as a witness to help to clear his name. This one also involves the murder and impersonation of a tax man, if that does something for you. The 11th story is definitely the weirdest. I'm just going to call it the Egg Lady. I hate to spoil it for you. There's a twist, so I'd recommend, if you're going to check out any of the stories just to get a sense of who the Mask Raider is, check out number 11. The 12th story is really jarring. All of a sudden, the Mask Raider, after all this time dressing like Dan Aykroyd in Exit to Eden, suddenly decides he's going to put on a red, somewhat looser fitting mask that's basically a bandana tied firmly to his face. He's got a yellow hat, a blue shirt, red pants, purple boots. It's horrible. And he gets a new, somewhat bolder logo. This story involves a French cowboy conspirator who is trying to break Texas from the Union by arming local Indians. Thankfully, the Mask Raider is almost entirely absent from this tale after the first few pages, as Jim Gardley takes center stage, trying to solve this mystery, tries to get himself in with the crooks. He leaves a trail to help the military come and save the day, so the Mask Raider doesn't have a lot to do. The end of the story promises you can read another Mask Raider adventure next month. This was a lie. There was not another Mask Raider story until sometime in the early 90s, when I believe in an issue of Midnight Suns Unlimited, they tried to tie the character in with the Ghost Rider lore. He was replaced by the Vision.
So this is another comment we have from our San Diego Comic-Con post, and it is also from Liz Birds. She says, "Before comics, I was all about Star Wars. I was one of those zealous Star Wars fans, I have to admit. That is, until the prequels came along and broke my heart, turned me into a bitter, angry Star Wars fan. We're worse than the happy, zealous ones. For episode 7, I'm not looking for CGI. I'm looking for practical effects and good old-fashioned story full of mysticism, camaraderie, and redemption. My hopes are low. I haven't read a lot of Star Wars comics except for Knights of the Republic series, which is very good, and I'm not a huge fan, but I'm intrigued by the Mark Waid Leia series because it's Mark Waid and because of that art. Looks gorgeous." Who's doing the art on that one?
Yeah, Terry Dodson's awesome. It's a great fit for Princess Leia. It's funny that she mentioned that because back when I had the first shop, I got into the Star Wars collectible card game. I would play it with people at my shop. When I moved to another shop, I would play it at their tournaments there. I was actually reviving my interest in Star Wars, and then the prequels came along, and that stuff's been in a box for 15 years now because of the damn prequels.
She goes on, "Agent Carter, one word, yeah, I'm psyched for that show. And I didn't know Johnston was rumored to direct an episode, which sounds like an absolutely awesome idea. Hayley Atwell is great, and having another strong female character in the Marvel Universe would be a good thing. Plus, it's set in the 40s, so count me in. I haven't seen more than the pilot of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but that's next on my list. Batman vs. Superman trailer, meh, not liking it, and never was a fan of The Dark Knight Returns. Gasp, says the internet. My expectations for this movie are rock bottom, so I'm beyond the point of caring. Lena Wonder Woman costume is underwhelming and not very inspiring. I was always partial to the old Wonder Woman skirt and wish they could have incorporated that idea, which they could have easily done. But I'm less worried about the costume and more about the portrayal. Is she going to be yet another shallow, violent, strong woman, quote-unquote, character? Or will she have some depth to her? What ideals will she fight for? One thing about the JLU cartoon, they're pretty clear that what Wonder Woman was fighting for on that show. And besides, or as VAP reopens the same day as BVS, so my enthusiasm is diverted."
Let me just point out, Warner Bros. Brothers blinked, they moved their date. I believe it's going to come out in March now.
No shit?
Yeah.
They backed off.
Yeah, I just read that as well.
Holy cow, that's crazy. We were just talking about how Marvel was like, bring it.
The other thing, too, is after all that Xena talk, somebody pointed out how much Wonder Woman looks like Teela, and I was like, zoinks!
I have to rescind on my last viewing on Wonder Woman. It looked alright. The costume looked alright.
She kind of looks like Teela, though, don't you think?
Yeah, she does. Yeah.
I don't think that she'll have any ideals. I think that she'll run around poking men with her sword.
No, I agree. That's maybe the point I addressed, too, that I think she's a really good point. That's something to be really afraid of. Is she just going to be a character that pops up so that we can be like, hey, we're like Avengers, too. We have multiple characters. You know, this is our excuse to get another one of our big heads on screen. Or are they actually going to, like, develop the character? They ain't going to develop shit. It's going to be all about Batman and Superman.
Well, have you seen that little promo that they showed online yet?
Yeah, the one where they take the scene from Dark Knight Returns and try to jazz it up.
Yeah, so I watched it. And, of course, the audience goes apeshit crazy for it. They're all screaming. I was like, it really wasn't that impressive. It was nice, but I wasn't like, oh, I got to see this now. It was kind of like, okay, they took what Snyder does so well, a image from a comic that I enjoyed, and he just put it back on he did a live version of it.
So what you're saying is Zack Snyder's entire career as a director.
Yeah, that's what he's saying.
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, one of the problems, too, with San Diego, which goes back to at least Snakes on a Plane, is that the SDCC echo chamber, where the people who are most excited about your project are the ones who are going to stand in line to get into the room to see your footage. So, of course, those people are going to be screaming and hollering. The question is, how will everybody else respond? And as Snakes on a Plane proved, not necessarily very well at all.
True.
Yeah, I think I agree, too. That does kind of, it's totally stacking the deck whenever you're doing it at Indio Comic Con, because like you said, those are going to be the people who want to go see that stuff. If you didn't care about it, you wouldn't have stood in line to get in there to watch it. So, of course, you're going to have cheering.
And there's definitely a vocal minority that liked Man of Steel, that have liked the direction they're going with. I just don't think that everybody else is going to be coming to the theater the way that they seem to think they're going to. Mr. Fix-It's longtime ex made a point of recording on VHS back when that was a thing, the pilot for the Justice League cartoon. And I have a similar reaction to that, which was that Superman got a cartoon series that lasted a few years to get him reintroduced to a generation of animated fans. Batman had his cartoon for years and years. Wonder Woman gets crammed into the Justice League cartoon. She always got short shrift. I think that Hawkgirl had that stronger fan base because she was a stronger character on that show. And I have a lot of resentment because Wonder Woman never had that cartoon of her own to help to develop that character for people to have a better idea of who she's supposed to be as opposed to the chick running around with the sword. And now I think in these movies they're going to throw her in as a love interest and the kick-ass strong chick. So it's going to friggin' suck.
No, I agree. And I'm already pessimistic about it, and I don't care about any of those characters. I can only imagine you actually have, like, this is Wonder Woman isn't going to get rebooted every couple years like Batman. Like, if Batman and Superman fans, their movies suck, they're like, okay, cool, we'll just wait for the next ones. This may be your only shot for a while, so that's what's really unfortunate about it.
And not just that, but Black Widow has been getting, like, I had issues with the casting of Scarlett Johansson in Iron Man 2. After Avengers, I started to come around to the character, and with the Winter Soldier, I've actually really gotten to like that character now, and she's had an excellent opportunity to develop over the course of several movies, and she's still not getting her own movie. So what chance has Wonder Woman got if it doesn't work out with this flick?
Oh, no, the flick will make money, but will it have legs to start kind of like, you know, the Marvel concept of having multiple movies? I don't think so. But it's going to make money.
But that's just it. The last one made money. It just didn't make the money they expected, just like with the last Spider-Man movie. They're changing up their plans big time on that. It's not that it didn't make money, it just didn't make as much money as it's supposed to. Now everybody wants their superhero movies to go into the $1 billion club. They're spending $250+ on the movie itself. They're spending another few $100 million on the promotion for it worldwide. So if it doesn't clear $1 billion, then it's a failure in a lot of these people's eyes.
Yeah.
All right, let me continue on with her comment here. So her next comment is Arrow. Okay, I'm intrigued that Adam is going to show up. When I think Brandon Routh, I didn't immediately think Ray Palmer. When I see where they're coming, but I see where they're coming from. I just saw the first season mainly so I can segue into The Flash. Not really in love with the show, but I take it for what it is, a superhero soap opera. I am enjoying the cameos. That's the best part so far. Rumor I heard was that, yes, it's supposed to be Ted Kord in that role since they name-dropped Ted Kord all over the first season, which got my hopes up. As DC, quote-unquote, has other plans for Ted Kord, so it was unavailable for Arrow, whatever the heck that means. But hey, instead we're seeing the Atom in a live-action TV show. Has that ever happened?
I'm pretty confident it hasn't. I don't even think that he was on the 70s superhero roasts. One thing I am kind of curious about, though, is they say that Ted Kord, there's plans for him. I have to wonder if maybe it's Jaime Reyes that they have plans for, the Blue Beetle character, and maybe Ted Kord's just getting wrapped up in that, because it's hard for me to believe that they're going to go off and do something with Ted that's greater than an appearance on Arrow. I don't buy that they're going to give him his own show, and I don't buy that he's going to appear in the movie universe. But Jaime Reyes, you're talking about a need for some ethnic diversity humanity in the movies and the shows, that would make more sense to me. That's another instance where don't get your hopes up too much about seeing Ted Kord just because he's been denied Arrow. It could actually be a double instead.
Okay, for her next comment, she says, John Cho was pretty good as Sulu, but what about an older actor like Ken Watanabe?
Remember when we were walking out of Godzilla, what we had to say about Ken Watanabe?
Yeah, I knew that as soon as I saw Ken Watanabe and I was about to read it, I was like, going to have issues with this.
Could you re-say that with my other name?
As soon as I read Ken Watanabe, I knew Frank was going to have issues with this because he basically plays Ken Watanabe in every single role he plays.
Well, it's not so much that. I mean, I can definitely tell Ra's al Ghul apart from his character in Godzilla. The problem is even though I know he speaks English, it seems like in every role, somebody has read him his lines and he's repeating them phonetically without understanding what they mean. And I've seen him in interviews, he speaks English, but his performances don't give me that impression. So if I don't even believe that he understands the words that are coming out of his own mouth, how am I supposed to believe the character that he's playing?
I have no problem with an Asian fellow playing Doctor Strange. I actually really like that idea, but I'm with her. You don't have to go young. Why do you have to get some young kid in there?
John Cho's in his 40s, I believe. He's no kid.
Okay, if you say so. I don't think so. I would think older, there was a Ken Watanabe. I'm sure there is another Asian actor that I'm just totally blanking on right now. I wouldn't be opposed to that, but I'm sorry.
Well, it's kind of funny because we had that whole generation of Asian actors in the 80s that I want to pull guys from like D.B. Wong or something, but D.B. Wong is probably a little bit too old at this point. So it's like, I can't think of anybody who's not like an action star or who isn't a star because of the work they're already doing in Asia as opposed to the American film industry. There's not a lot of Asian guys in the American film industry, and I went over pretty much the whole list of everybody who's currently working, and the guy who had the most visibility and seemed to be the best suited was John Cho. There's not a lot of other guys out there that have the right vibe to them. But I think you have to see the full range of their acting skill. It's just like you have issues with him because of Harold and Kumar, but Kumar has appeared in a bunch of stuff too. He was in House for a season. He's appeared in a bunch of dramatic series. I think you just need to have an exposure to him outside of like American Pie appearances and stuff.
I agree. And funny you brought up Kumar. So who was the dude? He was in the Grindhouse double feature and he was on Lost. Who's that? He's Middle Eastern.
Oh, yeah. I know who you're talking about.
I think he'd be good.
Well, like I said, I say Asian just because I think that there are roots in the comics to support that. But there are actually, there's a larger pool of Indian actors that I think would be solid. There's a few guys that I would rather not get in there just because they keep playing those type of roles. But there's actually a broader base of Indian actors. If they went Indian, I'd have no problem with that. And it'd probably help them open. I don't know what the Indian market is for American movies. It seems like they gravitate more toward their own homegrown stuff.
Naveen Andrews is his name.
I'd have to see him more stuff. The stuff I've seen him in, I don't feel strongly about.
Anyway, I think he'd be cool. Well, I think, I mean, even the British accent, I don't know. I just think that it's different enough to me. I don't know.
Sure. I just, anything but another white guy. We got, white guys are covered at this point.
Yeah. Okay, so then finally she ends with, watching comic book movies with non-comic book fans is awesome because you get to see everything as if it were new. Until recently, I completely isolated myself from Marvel Universe, and that made me enjoy the movies probably a lot more than if I'd read the comics first. And when some cameo reference, etc. does come up and you're watching with a neophyte, fun to explain what's going on to them. Also, I think Marvel's casting of well-known veteran actors is what helps draw in non-fans. Michael Douglas is Hank Pym. Well, I mean, that means I could bring my mother to see Ant-Man, and she doesn't even know the difference between Marvel and DC. Same idea with Anthony Hopkins in Thor, Robert Redford in the Winter Soldier, etc. I think it's a pretty brilliant strategy because it broadens out the audience appeal to older generation of moviegoers. I don't know if I really agree with that. I don't think anybody went to go see Winter Soldier because Robert Redford was in it. I think it was cool when he popped up and people were like, oh, snap, Robert Redford. Or Anthony Hopkins is Odin. Like, I don't think that he was billed. I mean, he popped up in the commercials, but nobody's pushing Anthony Hopkins as the star of Thor.
Well, one of the problems with both Anthony Hopkins and Samuel L. Jackson is there's no shortage of options to see those guys in a motion picture. You're not having to, like, hunt for movies that they appear in. Where Michael Douglas was, like, one of the biggest movie stars of the 90s, but he hasn't done so great in the last 10 to 15 years. But if your kid's going to go see a Marvel movie and it happens to have this guy that you used to think was awesome, it could help to get you to take... It's almost like take your parents to the Geek Fest day, thanks to Michael Douglas and Glenn Close and the like. It makes it a little bit more palatable for people who might have otherwise blown it off as just silly kid stuff.
So you're saying it may lend a little bit of legitimacy to it, I guess?
I would have trouble talking my father into going to see a typical Marvel movie. But, you know, one of his favorite actors is Donald Sutherland. So if I said, hey, you want to go see Donald Sutherland in one of the Hunger Games movies, I'd have a much better odds of talking him into it than I would have. Otherwise, he's going to want to go see The Expendables instead.
So my take on this is that these movies are going to make hundreds of millions of dollars no matter what, and these characters have nothing. I mean, it may be a nice little treat if you're an older person going to see the movie, but I think those people would already be seeing the movie, and I think they would either enjoy it or not enjoy it, and I don't think Robert Redford popping up in Winter Soldier was going to change that.
We gained a new Google Plus follower in Legion of Super Bloggers, and new Twitter followers in Archambaud, Felipe, and Guano Man. Favorites and retweets came from BCX Radio, Count Druncula, Pro Rebel, David Golding Artist, Eel Perrin, Eternal Rage, Firestorm Fan, IG at Perfectly Kesev, Infinity Watcher, Lispbirds, Longbox Graveyard, Mythmaking Etc., Pete's Basement, Professor Riptide, Sean McLaughlin, Silver Age Sensations, Squid Nova Studios, and Zomblicity. Silver Age Sensations wrote, loving the latest Guardians of the Galaxy podcast. I was also really glad to hear someone agree with me that Iron Man 3 was so disappointing, and I always say that. Professor Riptide noted, always a pleasure. Ange said, good stuff, thanks. Eternal Rage said, great episode. Well, all of them have been pretty good. Lispbird said, do I listen now or wait until after I've seen the movie? Hashtag decisions. Sean McLaughlin said, I remember the black and white Star-Lord as crashingly dull. I miss Vance, Charlie 27, Yondu, and the Crystal Guy. And when I noted that nobody knows the name of the Crystal Guy, he said, I think he was from Pluto in the future, when he was still a planet. Or something. I went ahead and looked it up on Wikipedia. The guy's name is Martin X, and now I have to ask, where's Nikki? Count Druncula said, verily, the Marvel Superheroes podcast is on iTunes. Just spent an hour ranking the Marvel movies for your podcast, so if you don't get to me in the feedback episode, we're done. Well, we got to you, and I think you got to us. Top 5 Road Crew noted that if you can get the podcast on iTunes, it should be on PodPay. I know ours is on PodPay. We are actually on Podbay now through Shout Engine, which provides the RSS feed to iTunes. So if you want to download that directly into your iPod or other Apple device, you can do that now. Unfortunately, we've had some issues with renaming our episodes on Shout Engine. You tend to have to hover over the title of the episode to find out what the episode is actually about. On iTunes, you have to go and check the description, and that's where it'll tell you which episode is which. I wanted to take a moment to explain a bit of a change with regard to our comments. Our goal for the show was always for it to run about a half an hour, and for as long as it was possible, we wanted to be able to read all the comments verbatim, and we wanted for each week's episode to respond to comments left on the previous week's episode. As you can note from this episode, that hasn't really worked out. It's reached the point where the comments are essentially overwhelming the show. You know, this episode is probably about 20 minutes of on topic, and then the rest of it's just us riffing off of comments. It takes about twice as long to edit that. There's been some discussion about maybe we could do a show just with the comments, or just decide to break down and do an hour-long show. The problem is that's still twice as much work in the editing. Another issue that we're going to have too is that we will most likely not be able to record any new episodes for about a month because of some scheduling issues. There will be episodes that you have not heard that were previously recorded. I'm going to edit in comments for as long as that is possible before the recording hiatus. But obviously we won't be able to do the comments at the end of each episode for the next several weeks most likely. This will be the last episode where we're going to do the verbatim comments, but I can say with certainty that next week's episode will be Annihilation Prologue, that I will be able to append some comments on the end of that episode, declare the next episode, and we'll take it from there. We are greatly appreciative of all the comments we receive, and you'll find that where the intention was initially read the comments on air and then discuss it on air, Mac and I have been much more active on the blogs, whether it's the WordPress or the Blogspot blog. We've offered great big heaps of text in response to your great big heaps of text. So we still have that communication. We want you to continue to write novellas like we got for the Guardians of the Galaxy episode, but we'll be addressing those more often in text with some highlighted portions read on the air from now on. So thanks again to everybody, and we'll see you next week.
After Reservoir Dogs, I had considered doing a Luke Cage Hero for Hire movie.
Wow.
Ed Pressman owned the rights at that time. Mm-hmm. And and we talked about it. And I talked with Larry Fish mm-hmm. about being Luke Cage. And he really liked that idea.